boy.
I'm boy.
Brothers, there's only one blood, cause it ain't no sense in us trampling on the stones. It's us, down, down to the bone. Blood is thick, waters were known well, cousins were kept apart, mothers were often memories. Fathers were not favorites on the farm, for he could do some harm, he could wreck the master scheme, for he, brothers, could dream. Your mama ain't no saint, your daddy died in a shallow stream, but your uncle Dr. King did have a dream, my brother. And what is your real excuse? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Free love and sex ain't nothing but a game. Don't never last, try hope. Take a chance on love, register to vote. Money ain't everything, but you could buy her a ring. Listen to little blackbird sing. Buy you a record of a yardbird with wings. Get into the swing of things. Homeboy, find some tenderness for a change. Home is where your history is, and it's not too late. Your uncle Dr. King wrote a book called Why We Can't Wait. Birmingham was yesterday. The mad dogs came to call on your mother's mother and sister. Your granddad had the blackened boots. You know what I'm saying, cuz it ain't but one blood. It's called fight for freedom now.
Homeboy,
love, love, love. Homeboy, fight for freedom.
Homeboy, your mama ain't no saint. Your daddy died in yesterday's freedom jazz dance. Your sister's on the street doing it with whomever she meets. Everybody you know is weak. Dope is strong. Women are free. Ain't nobody in school.
Homeboy,
listen to me. I know who you are.
Dying in the street.
Homeboy by Sonchi Ali. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you live from the Qumran Studio. This week on the Qumran Report, I will have an in-depth conversation with Mary Louise Patterson, the daughter of Louise Thompson Patterson and William Patterson. Mary Louise Patterson is the co-author of the excellent book, Letters from Langston, about letters from poet Langston Hughes to her parents and close friends. Excellent book. It would be her father, William Patterson, and his close friend, Paul Robeson, who on December the 17th, 1951, would take the United States before the United Nations and accuse the U.S. of attempted genocide against the descendants of the chattel slaves of America. Before we get into our interview, I would like to play a short 17-minute video Langston, as we knew him.
Baby, my curly-headed baby, I'll sing you fast to sleep and love you so as I sing. Oh, my baby, my curly-headed baby, just tuck your head like little bird beneath its mother's wing.
We actually knew Langston Hughes from the very beginnings of our lives. On the occasion of our births, he wrote to each of us to welcome us into the world. He did this because of his close ties to our two sets of parents, Louise Thompson and William Pat Patterson, and Evelyn Nebby Graves and Matt Crawford. When he learned of my arrival, he wrote me a card from Paris. It said, "To Nebby Lou from Langston, P.S. Glad you're here." And on a visit to California the following year, he saw me take my first steps.
When I came along a few years later, he sent me this handwritten first draft of this poem. "Mama, I found the soldier's cap lying in the snow. It has a red star on it. Whose is it? Do you know? He also enclosed a letter. Dear Mary Louise, this is for your first collection of original manuscripts. By the time you are old enough to read, I hope this war will be over. And by the time you are a big girl, I hope the red star will be shining everywhere and that you will be here a long time to enjoy all of its blessings. So be a nice baby and take your cod liver oil and grow up strong. With love from Langston. The story of the friendships between Langston Hughes, the Crawfords, and the Pattersons began with my mother, Louise Thompson, who would later become Louise Thompson Patterson. Louise was the first among our four parents to have a close personal friendship with Hughes, and it was she who brought her childhood friends, Matt Crawford and Evelyn Graves Crawford, into the poet's life.
Louise Thompson and my mother, Evelyn Graves, met in their teens and became best friends in the early 1920s, when Louise was a student at the University of California, and my mother, Nebbie, as she was known to family and friends, worked as a stenographer in San Francisco. My father, Matt Nathaniel Crawford, had migrated with his family to California from Anniston, Alabama, when he was a boy of 8, and attended high school with Louise in Oakland.
In the fall of 1927, Louise was a young teacher at Hampton Institute in Virginia. She and Langston met on the Hampton campus while he was there for a speaking engagement. Louise left Hampton soon after Hughes's appearance there and moved to Harlem. She had witnessed the brave student strike against the patronizingly racist white administration and felt she could no longer be part of the school. Once in Harlem, she became a part of the circle of artists and intellectuals whose most prominent figure was Langston Hughes. Earlier that year, my mother went to New York on vacation. During that brief trip, she met my father, San Francisco-born William Lorenzo Patterson, known as Pat to his friends. Pat and Langston had met earlier through their mutual friend, Paul Robeson, during the heyday of the Harlem Renaissance. Pat had settled in New York in 1920 and was well known in the community as one of Harlem's most prominent attorneys and dedicated political activists. He would later become a national leader of the American Communist Party.
Kein mal hast du gehst dem letzten Wege, wenn Himmeln bleiene verstellen bläue Tege, weil kommen wird noch unser Reus gebinkte Schau, uns wird der Poikt und unser Trott mir sein in Tor.
In the summer of 1928, Nebbie Graves vacationed in Harlem with her friend Louise, who introduced her to Langston Hughes and his circle of friends, including artist Aaron Douglas and his wife Alta, and the brilliant writer Wallace Thurman. Langston and Nebbie hit it off immediately. After a few weeks of the fast Harlem life, she would return home to the Bay Area and her sweetheart, Matt Crawford, whom she married the following year. Louise, in her early days in New York, worked for a time as secretary to Langston and novelist and folklorist Zora Neale Hurston. She was hired by their wealthy white patron, Mrs. Charlotte Osgood Mason. The relationships with Mrs. Mason came to a dramatic halt when the Park Avenue matron saw that she could no longer control Langston or Louise. She abruptly dismissed and humiliated them both.
One night, Langston comes to my house. He had been down to Mrs. Mason's. She was a very, very wealthy woman who had been a patron of the arts all of her life. Her particular interest was in what she called primitive people. She did not want him to write poems or articles of social protest. She wanted him to remain primitive, as he said. She had to control you. When she couldn't control you, she threw you out of her life. He was heartbroken, and he had been very grateful to have somebody that, for a time, that he didn't have to worry about. His brother went to school in New England. He was at Lincoln going to college. He was able to get his book out. He had me to work for him. So here was a woman who just had to rule or tried to ruin. And she made it very hard for Langston for a long time.
In March of 1932, Langston was on a speaking tour when he wrote Matt Crawford for the first time from Langston, Oklahoma. "Dear Mr. Crawford, thank you for your letter. I'd be happy to appear under the auspices you mention in Oakland or Berkeley. I shall be in California in April. I hope we shall meet. Tell Nebbie I'm anxious to see her. Sincerely, Langston Hughes." By May of that year, my father and Langston had become fast friends. Late that month, Langston sent Matt a telegram about an exciting prospect, a trip to Moscow that Louise had been organizing from New York. "Dear Matt, here's a copy of a wire from Louise. Moscow wires, all players must arrive Moscow by July 1st. Very necessary you arrive New York, ready to sail by June 15th. Have good group. Consult Matt. Wire immediately, Louise." So, if you're going, you'd have to get a passport at once. "Airmail Louise your decision. I hope you can go, Langston." The group of young black professionals, intellectuals, and artists had been invited to Moscow to make a film entitled Black and White about the state of race relations in the United States. Matt and Langston were roommates during their stay in the Soviet Union. There, in the heady atmosphere of the new socialism, they forged their friendship and commitment to radical political struggle. William Patterson had gone to the Soviet Union earlier. By 1928, he was seriously studying radical political philosophies and traveled to Moscow to continue to study socialism.
I was in Russia and I went to make a motion picture for Measure Poem Film. The picture must have been about the race relations in the United States and the labor struggles here.
We got there, we found, they had no idea what black folk were like in this country. Langston tried to work on the script.
I said, well, I don't believe we could make a picture from this scenario that anybody would believe anywhere in the world. And eventually, the film was canceled.
We left Langston because he decided to go into depth writing about that period.
With a press card, I was able to travel all over the Soviet Union. And I particularly wanted to see the Asiatic portions because there are colored people like myself. So I wanted to go and see how they live.
Matt, Louise, and Langston were profoundly affected and uplifted by their trip into Soviet Central Asia. On their return to the States, they would both become active in the fight to free the 9 Scottsboro boys of Alabama. At this time, they also joined the Communist Party, convinced that the only hope for black Americans was a fundamental change in an oppressive political, economic, and social order. Langston remained in the Soviet Union until the spring of 1933.
Back in the States, Langston throws himself into the Scottsboro Boys case. A mass movement was building to free the young men. Langston wrote and spoke on their behalf and went to visit them at the Scottsboro, Alabama prison. Later in the 1930s, he would travel as a journalist for the Baltimore Afro-American to cover the Spanish Civil War. Louise had also gone to Spain to help with relief work.
Spain at that time was a focal point for anyone who had any social consciousness at all, especially writers, came from all over the world to be in Spain. And so there was Langston.
A writer certainly has special duties, I would say, to society, because the written word is a force. And to misuse that power, to use it for false or ugly or lying purposes would seem to me morally wrong.
When Langston came back from Spain in 1938, he said, "Lou, I want a theater."
Together in 1938, Langston and my mother founded the Harlem Suitcase Theater. Their most successful production that year was Langston's play, Don't You Want to Be Free?
Throughout the 1930s and 40s, Langston spent a great deal of time in Carmel, California, at the home of his wealthy friend Noel Sullivan. He would often come up to Berkeley to go to the barbershop and visit with my family. He was playful and lighthearted some of the time, but he also confided in my parents and sought a sense of family among us. He also would seek their advice on serious personal and political matters. He called this needing clarification. In 1941, he was attacked by the evangelist Amy Semple McPherson for an early poem he had written called Goodbye Christ. Occasionally he was broke and borrowed small amounts of money from Matt and Nebbe, paying them back promptly when he received his next check from a speaking engagement or publishing project. In the early 1950s, Langston was called to testify about his political views before the infamous Senator McCarthy. Shortly after this ordeal in Washington, D.C., he sent our parents a summary of his testimony with a touching note explaining that, with the exception of Paul Robeson, he had not been forced to name names.
In June of 1957, Langston invited my parents and me to see his play, Simply Heavenly, on Broadway. My father, Pat, was very disturbed by the play and wrote Langston in part, "Dear Langston, Louise, Mary Lou, and I saw Simply Heavenly Tuesday night. Thanks for the tickets, and may I here and now very belatedly thank you for sending us I Wonder as I Wander and several other books. It is difficult to define my reaction to Simply Heavenly. I cannot say that I liked it. It did not appeal to me. Simply Heavenly does not say what so greatly needs to be said at this moment, Lang, at least not to me. So simple is the eternally recurring primitive Negro, so childishly simple and so simply childish. The time and place calls for something else. The Negro can today play the dominant moral role in American life. Thanks again. One must do more than dip one's fingers into progressive life. Sincerely, Pat." Langston answered the next day. In spite of Pat's harsh criticism, he replied without anger or surprise. "Dear Pat, I'm certainly sorry I wasn't at the theater the night you all came, as I would have loved to say hello to you. Your long letter is greatly appreciated, and your views valid in a number of ways, I am sure. When it comes to plays, it is a miracle to end up with anything at all one wishes left in the play, after 20 to 30 other people have had a hand in the creation, from the producers and director to actors. So all I can say is, I did the best I could under the circumstances. That it gets your serious consideration and you write me so helpful a letter is at least something to be grateful for. Best ever, and hope to see you and the family soon as work pressures let up. Sincerely, Langston." This correspondence could have caused a break in the friendship between these two men, but instead, their bonds of solidarity endured frank criticism and avidly held opinions.
In the 1950s and 60s, Langston's visits with us were less frequent, but he kept up with what we were doing and thinking. Mary Louise was studying in Moscow, and I was in graduate school in New York when news of her marriage to a fellow student at Patrice Lumumba Friendship University was announced. I called Langston to tell him about the news, and he was soon happy to receive her wedding picture. In the summer of 1966, on his way back to the States from Senegal, Langston passed through Paris, where I was living. My parents were visiting me at the time, and the four of us went out to dinner at a little restaurant in the Latin Quarter. Langston teased me that evening, telling me that I had no business speaking French better than he did. It was a joyous reunion, and after saying our goodbyes on a street corner facing Notre Dame Cathedral, we watched dear Langston walk up Boulevard Saint Michel in search of the next morning's New York Herald Tribune. It was the last time I would see him, for the following year he was gone.
So Langston, as we knew him, was someone who, along with our parents, dedicated his life to the cause of justice for Black Americans and other oppressed people around the world. He was our uncle and our friend. And through his writings and the books he suggested we read, helped us to understand the world and our rightful place in it.
I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, "Eat in the kitchen," then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful we are and be ashamed. I too am America.
Okay, I'm delighted to have with us in the studio Mary Louise Patterson. Mary Louise, welcome to the Coomran Report.
Thank you, Melvin. I'm really very happy to be here.
Can you give us a brief sketch of your mother so people can understand how important she was in terms of history? Can you talk about her for a while? Well,
I would be happy to do so. You know, mm-hmm. Louise's life spanned the 20th century, and she was a part of just about every movement for the liberation of African Americans and many labor movements that occurred in that century. She was born in 1901. She was born in Chicago. She grew up all over the West Coast as her mother and her stepfather were rather itinerant. My stepfather was looking for greener grass always on the other side of the fence. And so they were all over the West Coast, finally settling in California. So she grew up in towns where she often was the only Black child or one of two or three other Black children. And she would say, when recalling that period, that she was called nigger just about every day of her life. So she comes to California and to Berkeley when she is finishing high school and enters the university there. She's one of the first group of Black women to graduate from UC Berkeley, which incidentally just celebrated last year its 150th anniversary of the admittance of women to UC Berkeley, and Berkeley was the first UC campus. It was that early experience, Melvin, that experience with racism that molds Louise's thinking around why racism, what is going on here, and wanting to know more. While she's at Berkeley, W.E.B. Du Bois comes to Berkeley and he gives a speech. And Louise said that was the first time that she had seen an African-American man give a speech for over an hour with not a single note. And she walked out there for the first time in her life being proud. She walked out of the auditorium, that is, being proud for the first time in her life of being proud of being African-American. She graduates from UC Berkeley but can't find a job. No one is hiring educated Black women, university educated Black women. So she and her mother leave the Bay Area and go back east. Eventually she winds up in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, where they had just witnessed a lynching. And she said the terror from that lynching was like a tule fog, just blanketing the entire community, especially the Black community. And that's the first time that she experienced that kind of racial violence and the impact that can have on, and the intended impact, obviously, that has on a Black community. And from there, she goes to Hampton and she experiences at Hampton white philanthropy and the student rebellion, their strike, the famous Hampton student strike, and does not stay at Hampton the following year, but leaves and comes to Harlem. And by that time, it's towards the end of the Harlem Renaissance, but she had met, as it says in the film, she had met Langston when he came to talk about his book, The Weary Blues, on the Hampton campus. And so she renews that relationship in New York and is taken to meet their patron, Zora and Langston's patron at the time, Mrs. Charlotte Good Mason. And she is employed by Mason to become Langston and Zora's secretary. So she's coming to Harlem at a time when there is a confluence of both the Renaissance in terms of the cultural part of the Renaissance, but people forget the Renaissance wasn't just cultural, it was also political. And there were tremendous strong political strains and ideologies that were being debated in Harlem at the time. And socialism was one of those. Of course, there was nationalism. You had Garvey and Garveyism. And Louise was attracted to the Communist Party. She said that the Communist Party was the party that not only had an analysis, but that actually did something in the community. They were known, for instance, if a family was being evicted, people would say, go call the Reds, because the Reds would come and pick up the furniture off the sidewalk and put it back in the apartment. So Louise is attracted to this analysis, this left analysis of the world that we're living in, of the forces that are at play in that world. And she adopts that analysis. She agrees with it. And she was intellectually curious, always intellectually curious. And she and Langston, they all were intellectually curious. And this was a time when, you know, as you know, there was just so much fervor and activity in Harlem. So this was a really a heady moment in history. Mm-hmm. So she meets communists in Harlem. And she becomes a great organizer. She picks up organizing skills along the way. And James Ford, who was one of the leaders, African-American leaders in the young Communist Party, has been to the new Soviet Union and Red Russia. And he's coming back and he says, you know, they want to make a film. They want to make a film about Black workers and white workers uniting and overthrowing the boss, right? And the movie was going to be entitled Black and White, and they need Black people. Louise put together a group of people, which she does, and she's radicalized on that trip to the Soviet Union. And when she comes back, she joins the struggle for the freedom of the Scottsboro Boys. And as you know, that struggle was in part led by the Communist Party and my father. And from then on, she is involved in the struggles for political prisoners, black political prisoners in the United States. She is in an organization that she finally winds up working for called the International Workers Order, the IWO. They were a left social fraternity organization of workers, and she rises to become the vice president in that organization. And she then is called to testify when this organization is being challenged by the state of New York for their insurance policies. And later, when Angela Davis is arrested, she leads one of the Angela Davis, Free Angela Davis committees, and goes abroad, goes to London for Angela to organize there a Free Angela Davis committee. So her entire life was a life of activism, of political activism, of labor activism on the social front. And then she, of course, in the 1950s, I failed to mention, jumped over that, she organized a group of women called the Sojourners for Truth and Justice.
Yeah, and we're gonna talk about those yeah, in detail.
So mm-hmm. she did that as well. So that was her life, Melvin, and she could have kind of gone the other direction. She could have gone the traditional direction of an educated Black woman, you know, college-educated Black woman, smart, beautiful, and, you know, made her peace with the powers that be and lived a very comfortable bourgeois life.
Well, and let me just say this, because I'm waiting on a film yeah. about your mother to come in. I'm waiting on some studios like Tyler Perry, and this is a very important historical character. See, and we should begin to move in that direction, so the younger generations, they're looking for some kind of symbolism, some kind of history that's been hidden from them. Also, now, can you give us a little brief sketch about your father? And then, because a lot of this we're going to blow up and talk about it in details. Can you talk about your father, William Patterson?
So my father, William Patterson, is, oh, golly. There's so much to say about Pat. He's born in California. He's born at home. He is the last child of his mother and his father. And his birth is recorded in the Bible, as you know, it was often done when you were born at home. But the San Francisco fire, the earthquake, and then the subsequent fire destroyed the Bible. So there was no proof that my father had actually been born in the United States. And this becomes important during the 1950s in the McCarthy period. Pat, very early on, also is a rebel. He goes to law school. He is the first to graduate from Bolt Hall Law School, the first African-American, first African-American to graduate from law school. And the valedictorian, which he was, gets the plum law clerkship, you know, at the law firm of San Francisco. And when my father goes to claim this this position, he had to go up in the service elevator. He couldn't go up in the passenger elevator. And when he gets up to the office, the head of the firm says to him, you know, Pat is very smart. He knows that, you know, and very capable, but that none of his clients would want a Black man representing them. So no, he can't give him that position. And so Pat realizes that, you know, as a lawyer, a young lawyer, he's not going to find a position in California or in the West. And he goes east. And he goes east in the early 1920s. It's now the heyday of, or the beginning of, the Harlem Renaissance. He meets Paul Robeson. They become roommates. And my father joins the prestigious law firm, Black law firm, and is practicing law in New York when the Sacco and Vanzetti case occurs. Was also at that time being influenced tremendously by a man by the name of Cyril Briggs, who you should also do something about.
Yes.
And Cyril is talking about socialism to those young Black intellectuals and, you know, those who were curious, intellectually curious about socialism, about the Russian Revolution. And, you know, and about the forces of business and government that are responsible for the oppression of African Americans, but also of all people. So the Sacco and Vanzetti case occurs, and Pat goes to Boston to be a part of that that campaign to free Sacco and Vanzetti. He gets arrested. They won't let him ride on the inside of the paddy wagon. He has to ride on the outside of the paddy wagon. I understand that he was handcuffed to the bars on the window of the paddy wagon, and was on the running board holding on. And as a result of these, you know, these experiences, along with what he's learning from Cyril Briggs and others, he also knew Claude McKay, who had gone to the Soviet Union and met Lenin, and was a part of the Comintern, the Communist International, that stands for Communist International. Pat joins the Communist Party. Again, he sees that the party is at the forefront of the struggle for African American liberation, the struggle against racism, especially. And Pat goes to the Soviet Union, to the School of the Toiling Workers of the East, and he remains a member of the Communist Party until he died. And he comes back from the Soviet Union. He joins mass organizations such as the National Negro Congress, that then evolves into the Civil Rights Congress, which he headed. And in the Civil Rights Congress, gets involved in many legal cases of attempted legal lynching of African Americans who were accused of rape. Most of the time it was rape, and had been sentenced to death. But he also defends the Communist Party leaders who were accused during the McCarthy period under the Smith Act. Mm-hmm. And later he becomes an advisor to the Black Panther Party, who sought him out because of the genocide petition that mm-hmm. he and Paul Robeson presented in the 1951, charging yeah. the US government with genocide against the Negro people. So he also lived a life of activism. And he too, like Louise, could have chosen the other path, could have chosen the path of joining the Democratic Party, you know, becoming a lawyer, that's doing ordinary cases, not political cases, and could have made, you know, a nice living and had a comfortable life. But that's not the path that he chose either. And both of them believed that, they didn't believe that capitalism was the answer. In fact, they thought capitalism was the problem. Mm-hmm. They sided with those who also felt the same.
Can you, can you define for us, define socialism? How do you define that?
Socialism is an ideology, a theory, both political and economic, of the organization of society and the ownership of the means of production. So the means of production, the factories, the major industries, are owned by the government, and the government is the people. And the government is responsible for not only the ownership, but also the disposition of the wealth. And it is disposed of under socialism to those according to their ability. And under communism, it's to those according to the need. Mm-hmm. So in socialism, there still would be differences. You know, if we really had socialism, there would still be differences in terms of classes. You know, there'd be people who made more money or who received more goods from the government than others because of their ability.
Mm-hmm. And when people talk about Marxism, how do that fit into the puzzle?
Well, Marx developed that idea of, Marx and Lenin developed the idea of socialism and of the application of the idea of how the government would what the ownership would be and how that distribution would take place, and Marx also dissects capitalism, mm-hmm. And why that is capitalism is not the answer in terms of meeting the needs of all of the people.
Mm-hmm. What about the New Deal? What do you call that? How do you fit that into the puzzle? The New Deal of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Was that socialism or a combination of capitalism? What are your thoughts on that?
I think the New Deal measures that Franklin Delano Roosevelt brought in actually saved capitalism. As you know, it was, he came in on the heels of the crash, the Wall Street crash, the economic crash and the economic devastation, the fallout from that. That was actually the entire decade of the 1930s and really did not end until Second World War. So under the New Deal, there are some changes that need to be made in order to prevent the workers from taking over completely. So you get an 8-hour day. You know, you get no child labor. You get paid holiday leave. You know, those kinds of changes that are mandated by the federal government that actually then hopefully would placate the working class, which was, you know, rising up. I mean, we had, you know, bread lines, food lines. There was a lot of dissension. And the Russian Revolution was still quite young. You know, it had taken place in 1917. And its influence, the ideas that workers could actually run a country, you know, that you didn't need you didn't need the boss to run the country, that you could run the country, you the worker, that you could run the factory, you know, that you could be responsible for deciding how the goods that you produced in that factory were divided, how they were sold, and how you distributed the profits from that. So you know, in order to squash that possibility, that potential, you know, they make some modifications in robber baron capitalism that's, you know, that defined kind of the end of the 19th going into the 20th century and put some governors on capitalism.
Yeah, and another discussion, maybe for another time, is I thought one of the important things about the New Deal was the Federal Theater Project that employed so many writers and artists, and et cetera, like that. And I remember reading something. Get back to your excellent book. We talk about that because I remember reading something about Langston Hughes and the reason that he failed to become part of the Federal Theater Project. Yeah, I think that he mentioned something like, might have been in the Big C or something like that, because he didn't want that kind of, he wanted more artistic freedom. But look, let's get back to talking about your book. You know, can you remember when I picked up that book from Essawan Bookstore here in Los Angeles. And the owner, and it's still sticking in my mind, he said, "This is my favorite book." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because it showed how we have lost the art form of letter writing." And when you read that book, can you talk a little about, because when I read the book, I felt the same way. You know, some of these letters were just artistic masterpieces. You know, can you talk a little about your book?
Sure. I just want to say, you know, that to finish up on the New Deal, you know, it left Black folks out, right?
Okay.
Right. It was a New Deal, but it wasn't for us. It was no New Deal for us. Yes. So when my parents, Louise and Pat Patterson, and my co-author's parents, Evelyn Louise's parents, Evelyn and Matt Crawford, were best friends, and they were best friends to Langston. So the five of them corresponded for almost 40 years. My mother was the last one of the quintet to leave us. And when she did, Nebby Lou and I had grown up seeing this correspondence with Langston. And in fact, we had corresponded with Langston ourselves, but we had kind of forgotten about that. So after my mother died, we decided to take a look and see if Langston had kept any of the letters that our parents had written to him, since we had the letters that he had written to them. So So we went up to Yale to the Beinecke Library to where Langston's ephemera, his works, his writings and so forth are housed, are preserved. And we, to our real surprise, Langston had kept so many of the letters that they had written him, and including letters that we had written him that we'd totally forgotten about. And, you know, reading the letters that they had written to him and having read over and over again the letters that Langston had written our parents, we realized that this couldn't just be something that we passed on to our families, that it remained private in the hands of, you know, just our families, that this correspondence really illuminated a side of Langston that was often either denied or excused, that Langston somehow was a radical when he was young, but then when he was older, he kind of put aside those little boy ideas and grew up and was no longer a radical. But that clearly wasn't the case. These letters were a testimony to that. So we felt we needed to publish the letters. Neither one of us was a writer. Neither one of us had ever written a book. But, you know, we were determined. And it took us, you know, over 10 years, Melvin, to do it. We didn't have an editor. We didn't have a publisher. You know, we didn't have any advanced monies. We didn't have any graduate students to help us do any of the research. You know, we had to do it all ourselves, but we did. And with the help of Professor Robin D.G. Kelly, who wrote the introduction to the book, we were able to get the book published. And we feel it's an excellent book and it takes its place, you know, on the library shelf with all of the other Langston books, as a book that really should be read. The correspondence is all over the place. As you know, it's humorous, it's pathos, it's political, it's profound, it's personal, it's poignant, it's wonderful.
And it's universally available, right? At all of these bookstores, they can get it.
Yeah. It may not be in the bookstore, but you can ask the bookstore owner to order it from UC Berkeley was the publisher, the UC Berkeley Press. I'm sorry, the University of California Press that's located in Berkeley. And it can be ordered from them. And yes, we really want people to read the book. We think that they'll not only enjoy it, but that they'll learn a lot about the period, that whole 20th century, and the struggles of African Americans, particularly the left, the Black left, which many people don't know even existed, and the struggles that they were involved in, and their part in it, and Langston's part in it, up to the very end of his life, Melvin.
Let me ask you, what was the name of that last poem, that little short, beautiful poem about sitting at the table, et cetera, like that? They sent him away because he was a darker one.
It's I Too.
I Too, yeah. Mm-hmm. Great, great poem.
Yes.
Okay, yes. Look, let's talk a little about the great Paul Rose. Let's talk about, what are your thoughts? Do you remember the first time you met Paul Rose?
I met him before I was born. He and my father were roommates in the 1920s in Harlem, and they married best friends. Paul married Islanda Cardoza Good, and my father married Minnie Summers. My father's marriage to Minnie did not last. Paul and Essie's did. So he was in my life before I was born. And then he became almost like an uncle, a figure larger than life. Of course, you know, he was a tall man and a big man. You know, he had girth, you know, and he had that beautiful bass voice. What can I say about him? You know, the gentleness.
Go ahead.
You know, the times that we shared meals together with Paul and Larry Brown, his accompanist at the time, who was also a dear friend of my parents. I just kind of remember him, Melvin, as being larger than life.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that famous picture when your father returned from France from delivering the document over there? That's a famous picture of you, your moms, et cetera, like that. And you is standing there. I think you must have been, 12, 13 years old, something like that, in 1951.
I was 8 years old.
You was 8 years old.
I'm telling my age.
And you got a doll in your hand, et cetera, like that. And I think you're holding either Paul Rose's hand or your mom's hand. It's a famous picture.
Yeah.
Do you remember anything about that? You were too young at that time.
I think, you know, I've heard the story told over and over again. So I don't know if it's my memory or it's just my memory of the story. Mm-hmm. Or some combination of the two. Mm-hmm. But yes, my father had returned from a trip to Europe to present the genocide petition. And the US government had tried to stop him every stop of the way. And he managed to be one step ahead of the government. They were trying to take his passport while he was overseas and force him to return home early. But he managed to stay one step ahead of them. And so he returns to the United States only to be really humiliated at Idlewild, which is now JFK Airport, but back then it was called Idlewild Airport in New York City. And that picture is taken. That was the committee that was waiting for him to come out, you know, of the customs and immigration to receive him, to welcome him back home. Mm-hmm. It had been, despite the US's attempt to sabotage the trip, it had been a very successful trip. And Pat got press all over Europe about genocide. And there was absolutely no press here in this country until the Times wrote something, some small little article. And then Walter Winchell gets on the radio and denounces my father with a number of things he said, which were totally untrue. You know, a lot of misinformation. But that was the committee that was waiting for the reception committee, waiting for him. And they tried to strip search my father. They took apart his suitcase. They went through everything that he had in the suitcase. They went through every piece of clothing that he had on. They turned the pockets inside out. And it was like several hours later, my father emerges with tears of rage in his eyes. You know, emerges to this welcoming committee that Paul was the head of, and
yes.
You know, and really understands what has happened, because it's in Pat's eyes, understands what has happened to Pat, and embraces him like, you know, one brother embracing you know, the brother who has just been released from prison, you know, from the clutches of the master.
He talked about a lot of that in the another book that I recommend. It's autobiography, The Man Who Cried Genocide. Mm-hmm. You know, detailed a life coming from the mouth of William Patterson. And the other excellent book by Gerald Horn is also this, you know, Black Revolutionary, that details a lot about that. But, you know,
add to the end of that story is that Pat's passport was taken. And he was not to get it back until 1960.
Mm-hmm. And then what I was getting ready to say is a lot of misconceptions also on when Paul Rosen was introduced to these particular radicals. And a lot of people forget that Paul Robeson come in contact with the Provincetown Players. And the Provincetown Players was founded by John Reed, the one that wrote 10 Days to Shock the World, Emma Goldman, Jiggs Cooks, all of them was the one that founded this. And he succeeded the great actor, Charles Sidney Gibson, who ran over 200 performances on Broadway in the Emperor Jones before the Paul Robeson took it over. But that was a radical theater company. And it influenced his thinking a lot at that particular time. Just wanna bring that up. Also, before we get away from that, I wanna talk about why do you think the film Black and White, when your mother, Langston Hughes, all of them, what do you think that was looked upon as a failure, why they couldn't complete that film?
Well, first of all, the film itself, according to Louise's stories that, you know, that she told later and Langston in his book, and then Matt, who had been there, my co-author's, Evelyn's father, the script was impossible. It had been written by a German. They knew nothing about Black people. They knew nothing about, in brief, the story is that there are workers who are working in a factory in the South. They go on strike. White workers are organized in the North to come down to the South to help the Black workers. We have Black and White unite, and they defeat the factory owner. You know, just a totally implausible script. And one of the reasons that Langston stayed behind after on that trip in 1932 was to work on the script and to try to turn it into something that would be plausible, that could be believable. And the hope was that they would return back the following summer to make the film, to complete the film. Mm-hmm. The other thing is they weren't actors. There was one person who was an actor amongst them. The rest of them were just, young people who had managed to put together $90, Melvin. It was $90, which was a fortune back then for the one-way ticket. The Russians said that they would pay the fare home, which they did. Mm-hmm. And they were also paid while they were there. Even though the film never got made, they got paid. They got toured of the country. They went down to Uzbekistan. So they're put up in a hotel. They're fed. And they're, you know, they're having a good time. Mm-hmm. The film itself, the script was impossible. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that the Soviet Union at the time, Russia at the time, was trying to get to be acknowledged by the United States. They wanted the US government to acknowledge their new government. And there was a man who was building the hydroelectric dam, the Dnieper hydroelectric dam, and he was against the film being made. And it is said that he went to Stalin and said, "Don't make the film. If you make the film, I won't finish the dam." Mm-hmm. So you know, who's going to make a film when you need to bring electricity to a country? You know,
exactly.
So anyway, that's the story that I know.
All right. Just a couple more things before we open up for some Q&A. Is, you know, I just finished doing some research when Langston Hughes came down to the Mississippi Delta during the time of the flood in 1927, and also when he came down in 1932 as a guest of the poet William Alexander Percy. Mm-hmm. When he spoke at his mansion, and he also did a reading at the St. Matthew African Methodist Church at that time. But the most interesting thing in the 1927 trip was a ride back with Zora Neale Hurston. And that leads into the conflict that they had about the play Mule Bone. Can you talk a little about that? Because, it, you know, today when you put that in proper perspective, it would be a dramaturg as opposed to a co-writer, et cetera, like that. Can you explain what happened and talk a little about that conflict that impacted their friendship?
You know, a lot has been written about Mule Bone. Mm-hmm. I know what my mother said about that whole situation. She was hired by Mrs. Mason to be Zora and Langston's secretary. And Mrs. Mason insisted that they leave Harlem because there were too many distractions, according to Mrs. Mason, that they leave Harlem, that they go live in New Jersey, which was the Garden State then. It was, you know, it was pretty rural and agricultural. And so they are sent to the Garden State to work on this play. Of course, they would escape all the time, and especially Zora, and come back to New York and, you know, go to parties and so forth. I think it's a complicated situation. Zora accuses Langston of bringing my mother into the play as a person who is deserving of proceeds from, you know, any kind of royalties that the play may have garnered. And so she goes to Cleveland. Langston at the time happened to be in Cleveland, and she goes to Cleveland, and there's a big showdown in Cleveland where Zora reads Langston the Riot Act and says the play is all hers, that, you know, was her idea, that there's only one or two things that Langston wrote or did with the play that could be identified as being clearly his, and that Louise is just a secretary and she's not deserving of any money and from the play, any proceeds from the play. And this was in front of the Karamu players. The Gilpin players at the Karamu Theater, excuse me, mm-hmm. Gilpin players, that same Charles Gilpin that you were mentioning earlier. And that was really the beginning of the end of what was a fantastic, not only friendship, but collaboration between Langston and Zora. And, you know, it's only our conjecture, but we know that had they continued as a collab, in collaboration, that they would have produced some wonderful plays and some wonderful works. But this was really manipulated Mrs. Mason as the grand puppeteer who is whispering in Zora's ear and telling her, what to do. And Mrs. Mason accuses my mother of being ungrateful and trying to sow dissension. And so my mother leaves Mrs. Mason's employ. This is during the crash. And my mother had no other source of income. And not only that, but my grandmother was ill with and dying with cancer. So it was a very, very unfortunate, calamity, really, that this relationship, was destroyed, you know. Mm-hmm. And Zora was, as she's been described even by her biographers, was a very complicated person. She was brilliant. She was funny. She was a raconteur. She was My mother said she was the best storyteller she'd ever, ever met, that she'd have you cracking up on the floor, that she could imitate each person that she was talking about in the story. She could imitate each person, you know, like, you know, with precision. And, but yeah, that friendship, that collaboration was destroyed.
Yeah, and that's another individual who this modern generation should be trying to make a film or something like that about, because a lot of people, well, anyway, let's just move on to, I want you to talk about this, the Journal for Truth and Justice, a little about that history and the updates on, because I think you brought that particular organization back into existence. Can you talk a little about it?
Yes. So in 1951, as a result of the Paul and my father's presenting the petition to the United Nations, the genocide petition to the United Nations, and embarrassing the United States on the world stage, their passports were taken. And then Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois is brought up on charges of treason, almost. Mm-hmm. And his passport is taken. And so these men are under attack. Alpheus Hunton was another who was an associate of Dr. Du Bois's. And so they decide, my mother, and at that time, the actress Bea Richards had moved from California to New York and was living with our family, that Black women need to organize and to defend Black men and defend the Black community. And they called themselves the Sojourners for Truth and Justice. And within something like 6 weeks, they had organized nationally. They had a call, a beautiful call. I don't have a copy of it in front of me, but you can go online and, you know, it can be found online. A call that was written by Louise and Bea. They stayed up all night writing this call, literally stayed up all night writing the call. They had women from all over the country joined them, and they organized a trek to DC, a demonstration in DC. They were going to go to the White House, to the Pentagon, and to Congress and demand the release of Du Bois, the return of the passports that were they were stripped of, my father and Paul and Du Bois, etc. And they, you know, they lived maybe a year and a half, mm-hmm. Destroyed by, you know, McCarthyism, really.
And Rosalie Ingram.
Yes, they fought for Rosalie Ingram. They also took on some of the cases that the Civil Rights Congress was at that time trying to defend, and Rosalie Ingram was one of those. Who was facing the death penalty for killing a white man who attempted to rape her.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you see a similarity between Black Lives Matter and, what do you say the similarities and the difference?
Absolutely, oh. Well, you know, Melvin, I'm not a historian, you know, mm-hmm. nor a sociologist. Mm-hmm. But clearly, this is a movement to save Black lives, you know, mm-hmm. to save the Black community and to mobilize. And it was mobilized by Black women, yes. which the Black Lives Movement was as well, you know, started by three Black women. Mm-hmm. And it's a movement that's highlighting the injustices that are meted upon the Black community. You know, and attempting to defend the Black community, mm-hmm. and also to bring to light, to expose those injustices.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, before we, of course, you're going to have some closing comments at the end, but also I know that you are a physician, a doctor, et cetera, like that. And I want to ask you your thoughts on the biggest health problems facing the Black community. What are your thoughts on that?
I think one of the biggest health problems facing the Black community is that people don't have health care. People don't have access to health care. They don't have access to adequate, decent standard of care. And if they have access, if there's access to it, they don't have the money to pay for it. So that the lack of universal health care, I would say, is probably the biggest health deficiency.
Okay.
Clearly, we can talk about, you know, the other issues that are always enumerated, the diabetes and the obesity and the hypertension, but the stress of racism, the constant, relentless stress that being Black faces, you know, here in the United States, and the impact that that has on our health is just beginning really to be acknowledged by, the major medical institutions. This chronic exposure to elevated levels of steroids and the other stressors, that we normally produce, but that are produced only in moments of need, you know.
Let me ask you this in relationship to health, because I know you was a doctor dealing mainly with young people. What are your thoughts right now? I think this is the last question actually about that, in terms of the vaccine for young people. Okay. What are your thoughts on that?
Let me just mention the other factors, you know, in terms of health. The lack of adequate housing, the lack of, you know, jobs, of adequate nutrition. So the social determinants of health are, I think, also, you know, the biggest factors in terms of the health of the Black community. In terms of the vaccine, can you ask me the question again?
Vaccines in relationship to young people, especially the one I'm talking about. I'm not talking so much young people in college, as we just see the teenagers on down. What are your thoughts on
that? Are you talking about the COVID vaccine?
Yes.
I guess I subscribe to the party line. I think that the vaccine should be given to children who are 12 and older. And that has been approved by the Academy of Pediatrics. For children, 12 and older, along with the CDC and the FDA, et cetera. In terms of younger children, there is discussion going on and a debate going on whether healthy children younger than the ages of 12 should get the vaccine or not. There has been a transient but potentially serious, although they have not described any serious cases, of a heart condition in some young people who have gotten the vaccine, who were prior to that healthy. They have all gotten better. No one has died from it. No child has died from that condition. And, you know, what we don't know is if they will, although they seem to be perfectly well now, will 20 years from now, they show signs of a heart malady that could have been caused by the vaccine. Mm-hmm. But we don't know that, you know, but I think that children 12 and older should get the vaccine. I think they need to return to school and to normal life to be able to socialize. So yes, I am pro vaccine for 12 and older.
Okay, I'm going to take a few minutes and talk about a project that I'm working on very quickly, and then we're going to come back for the Q&A and then your closing comments. And what I would like to do now, I'd like to take a few moments to mention a project that I'm working on for the first part of 2022. And this is setting up Nisana centers in the Mississippi Delta, working with my brother, Reverend Roosevelt Johnson, who's the pastor of Evergreen Baptist Church in Greenville, Mississippi, and my brother, Reverend Freddie Johnson, who's the pastor of the Zebedee Baptist Church in Memphis, Tennessee. And these Nisana centers would focus on after school programs and anti-violence situation coping group. And the Nisana centers is based upon, I know you probably can't see it too clearly, but it's based upon two models, the community theater model, which is the harmonious integration of seven components working in the spirit of harmony to present community theater to the community under a national rate concept, relevant, affordable theater experience situated in 24 areas of the United States of America. And the components of the community theater model is the word, the artist, the audience, the drama stage group, which is the front of the house and the back of the house, the Young People's Theater Company, which is based upon the YACART model, which is young people, conflict resolution, after school programs, reading programs, and theater programs. And the Nisana model takes its name from the first letters of six concepts working in a spirit of harmony to impact the violence in the individual, home, school, and community. And those concepts is nutrition, exercise, spirituality, one-on-one, needs fulfillment, and the anti-violence situation coping group. And you can find all this information in my upcoming book that should be coming out within the next couple months, on how to put together the National Black Theater, Black History Theater Company, how to create the Charles Gipling National Theater Company. So I'm looking forward to that. I just wanted to get that information out. Now let's go back and see if there's any questions from the chat. Pam, do we have any questions?
So audience, this is your time to tell me if you want to go live. Hit the raise hand. Otherwise, I'll just make you all live.
Okay, if it's no questions or comments from the—
Give them a second, give them a second. Sometimes it takes them a minute. All right, and scene. Go ahead. I just don't want to, I made a mistake by sending the email out, or the note out to, I'll make you all live, because that takes away their autonomy. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So I asked them later, if you want to go live, hit the raise hand or hit up the chat, and they're all still sitting here watching. But wait, Harold. Okay, hang on. Harold, I'm going to move you. Give me a second, Harold. I'm going to move you to live, Harold. Allow to talk. Harold, you should be live.
I see Harold.
Yeah.
Mary Louise.
Turn on your camera if you want to.
Okay, let's see. Can't see how I can turn it on here.
Okay, then hang on, let me do this. Then do that. Try it again. I I see you live as a panelist, but there you go.
Yes.
Anybody else, raise that hand. Raise that hand or drop it into the chat, and I will move you to panelist so you can talk with our wonderful guests. Go ahead, Harold. Sorry.
Okay. Mary Louise, given, given all of your history, you've talked so much about your family, your friends, but tell us what you're doing now. Because you're still just like your mother, your father, and all of your friends. Share with us what you're doing and have been doing.
Thank you. Thank you, Harold. I currently am a member of a wonderful discussion group that Harold and his wonderful partner, John, host, and have hosted for several years. And it's a discussion group that of people of many ethnicities and ages and gender identifications and backgrounds, personal backgrounds. And we discuss issues revolving around race and racism in this country. And we try to understand one another, and by understanding one another, to understand others in our community as well, and to try to influence, you know, for change, for progressive change, to fight against racism. So that's one thing that I do, and that's Harold and John's project. And I also am a part of an organization called Uptown Progressive Action. And we have a medical subcommittee, a health subcommittee. And we're really working around trying to get single payer New York Health Act passed in the New York legislature. I also am on the board of the Physicians for a National Health Program, and so active around trying to get universal health care, not just insurance, adopted here in the United States. So those are some of the things that that I am doing at this moment. Well, at this time, at this very moment, I have revived Nana's taxi service, and I'm in Los Angeles, driving my two grandchildren around to their summer camp activities. Nana's taxi service.
Okay, that's wonderful. Is there any more, Harold? Is that it?
Yes, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Harold.
Thank you, Harold.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you can go ahead and kill your video feed. We don't have anybody else right now, but that's not a negative thing. Sometimes absorbing all, absorbing all the awesome, you just have to think. Charlotte Plummer says, thank you, Melvin and Mary Louise, for such an informative talk. With all the current talks and discussions surrounding teaching race in the school system and critical race theory, what are your thoughts on how to teach race in the school system?
You want to handle that, Mary Louise?
I'm not sure I can handle that. I mean, certainly there needs to be a curriculum that is developed that, in terms of teaching history in general, incorporating it, in my opinion, I guess just to answer the question broadly, I don't think I could be very specific about it. I'm not a pedagogue. That's not my area of expertise. But I certainly think that race, racism, and the history of such is central to American history. And so American history has to be rewritten. How it's taught, what is taught has to be completely rewritten to incorporate from slavery from 1619 on to 1865, right, Juneteenth, to 2021. It has to be inclusive of racism and the history, you know, the and Jim Crow, it's slavery and Jim Crow, and that has to be incorporated into American history. I don't see it being taught separately. I really do see, and you know, maybe you disagree, but I really do see that as central to the story of America, the story of this country, is the story of the relationship to the enslaved and to the indigenous people who were genocided. And then to the enslaved people who were ultimately almost, you know, completely wiped out. But, you know, the definition of genocide also means the partial destruction of a people, not that it doesn't have to be the total destruction of a people. So that's my answer.
Well, let me say this. I think in terms of rewriting, because see, it's a lot of information out there already. What I would suggest is read these particular books. The Miseducation of the Negro by Carter G. Woodson. Read that. Stolen Legacy by George G. M. James. Read that. You know, the read some of the works of J. A. Rogers, Nature Knows No Color Line, et cetera, like that. All of these are scholarly hidden books. And another important book, to me, one of the most important books in dealing with this racial situation, is a book called The Creation of the White Race by Theodore Allen. See, the information is there, they just keep it away from us. And then we need to take control of our public school system, you know, that the descendants of chattel slaves of America, you know, really developed that. But right, that's why I suggest the book Stolen Legacy, which has some excellent information about these 114 Black schools and how to redevelop those. Because that this critical race theory that they're talking about is just a rehash of what these books talk about. Carter G. Woodson started talking about this in the late 20s, early 30s, you know. So those solutions are there.
Mm-hmm. Melvin, I would add, but it has to be taught to everybody. It's not just taught to African-American children or children of, you know, people of color. This is American history. So it's taught to everyone.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt, because right now I'm doing some research in the Mississippi Delta. I'm reading a book now called Development Arrested by Dr. Woods. And he really examined a lot of what we're talking about. That's another book that I suggest in terms of what was happening in the Mississippi Delta in relationship to the power structure of what the planter class did, et cetera, like that. But I agree, this public school system, when we talk about the public school system, see, this book points out how the power structure moved to a private education system and left, like when I was coming up down in the South, I went to all segregated schools. See, and those schools that was 100% white, now they're 99% African-American, and the whites is in mostly private schools. But I agree. You know, this history must be taught to everybody as a whole. So,
John, may I throw in a couple of more books?
Yes.
The History of White People by Nell Painter. It came out a few years ago. It's genius. New York is Burning by Jill Lepore. Just those two. Looks like we don't have any more.
Okay, so we're gonna go for closing comments. from Mary Louise. So, you know, I'm so glad that you're here to impart all of this information on us. And keep in mind that probably sometime next week, our tech director will edit, they will go over and I'll make sure I get this video to you so you can get it around. But closing comments, and tell us again how to get our hands on this great book about Langston Hughes and letters, this classic book.
Well, I'll start with the letters. The book is entitled The Letters from Langston, From the Harlem Renaissance to the Red Scare and Beyond. And it's co-authored by Evelyn Louise Crawford and Mary Louise Patterson. It was published by the University of California at Berkeley, and it can be ordered from any bookstore. The bookstores used to have them, Barnes and Nobles. It could be ordered on Amazon, although I hate to plug Bezos.
Hold up the book, please. Melvin has the book. Hold up the book, please, in front of the camera so people can see it.
And again, it's a wonderful...
Awesome.
It's a wonderful correspondence. It's a wonderful history of an incredible friendship between five people. Friendship, comradeship. And we annotated it. We did a lot of research to provide the context for the letters. It's a wonderful history of the African-American left, and specifically the Communist Party, but generally the African-American left. And I really strongly recommend, not just because I co-authored it, but I recommend it to everyone to read. I want to thank you for bringing the my father, my mother, Paul Du Bois, Louis Burnham, and Dorothy Burnham, James Jackson, and Esther Jackson, Ben Davis and his wife, Altheus Hunton and Dorothea Hunton. So many African Americans who were communists, who were leftists, who dedicated their lives to the struggle for the freedom of their people and against capitalist exploitation. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I hope your audience will read about them. There are wonderful biographies of my father and my mother. There are biographies, obviously, of Paul. There are biographies of Du Bois, of course, and books by Du Bois. There's also a wonderful book of correspondence between Esther and James Jackson. So please do read, learn these stories so that we know whose shoulders we are standing on.
And thank you very much. I want to shout out to the Robert Theater Company, because Ben Guillory and Danny Glover they did a production, a reading of my play, Revolutionary Genocide, you know, dealing mainly with your father. And I know they got an upcoming production of that coming, so a shout out to them. And I wish I had time to discuss Benjamin Davis Jr. in details, but that's something that we can do in the future. So I would like to extend a special thanks to our special guest, Mary Louise Patterson. Now, you can find a video of today's event on my website, dramastage-coomram.org, within the next 2 days. Thank you for tuning in to the Coomram Report, and from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with a song that opened the show, Homeboy by Sungji Ali.
Homeboy.
Homeboy.
Brothers, there's only one blood, cause it ain't no sense in us trampling on the stones. It's us, down to the bone. Blood is thick, waters were known well, cousins were kept apart, mothers were often memories, fathers were not
my favorites on the farm. For he can do some harm, he can wreck the master scheme. For he, brothers, could dream. Your mama ain't no saint, your daddy died in a shallow stream. But your uncle, Dr. King, did have a dream, my brother. And what is your real excuse? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Free love, that sex ain't nothing but a game. Don't never last, try hope. Take a chance on love, register to vote. Money ain't everything, but you could buy her a ring. Listen to Little Blackbird.